Thanks for listening to another episode of Project Zion. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts the Restoration offers for today's world. Project Zion is sponsored by the Latter-day Seekers team from Community of Christ.
And welcome to another episode of the Project Zion podcast. I'm your host, Brittany Mangelson, and tonight we have on Amy Cartwright, who lives in Calgary, Canada, who is a new member of Community of Christ. So welcome, Amy.
Thanks, Brittany.
So today we're just going to introduce Amy and talk about her faith transition into Community of Christ. So she came from the LDS Church. And so we're just going to chat like friends sipping lemonade on our front porch and just talk about all things faith transition. So, Amy, why don't you introduce us just a little bit? Give us a little bit of background to maybe why you're in Canada or what you do for a living, et cetera, just to get to know you a little bit before we jump into your story.
Sure. My husband and I are both Americans, and we moved to Calgary 6 years ago. We just happened to graduate during the downturn, and there weren't any jobs really for my husband in the U.S., but there was one here in Canada. So we moved up here 6 years ago. We thought that we'd probably be here for 2 to 3 years, and we have stayed and now plan to stay indefinitely. So that's what brings us up here. I finished my master's in music at Brigham Young University. And with the move to Calgary, I just didn't really know very many people up here. So that took a bit of a backseat, and it has continued to take a backseat. And I currently stay home with my children, and I do some seamstress work, but I don't work outside of the home very often. But I joke all the time that I'm actually the perfect Mormon, or I was like the perfect domestic Mormon wife. I was a trained musician, and I'm a seamstress, and I homeschool my children and all these things. And yet, that's not exactly how life went for me, but you know, I like to can in the summertime. So
oh, yeah, I saw your pictures on Facebook a couple weeks ago. That's pretty good.
Yeah. Great skills.
They are great skills to have. I mean, they're skills that I should probably take on myself, but you know, I'm still learning how to be the good Mormon housewife, I guess.
It's cool. At the end of the day, it's a lot cheaper just to buy it anyway. So, you know, don't fret over it too much.
I've made freezer jam before, but I haven't actually canned anything. So,
well, next time I'm down in Utah on a hot, sticky day, we'll torture ourselves.
Oh, great. So let's just jump in to your growing up. Just what was faith like in your home as a child? I know you said you grew up in America and grew up LDS. So what role did faith play in your childhood?
Well, like most LDS kids, it was a huge part of who I was. My mom was a convert to the church. She joined when she was 16. She found out about the LDS Church from Donny Osmond. She is, my mom's British. She's from England. And apparently the Osmonds were huge over in the UK. And that's how she found out about the church. So she joined when she was 16. And then my dad served a mission in England. And that's how they came to know each other. I've been assured there was no funny business. But that they were just acquaintances. And then when my mom came over to Utah one summer, they decided to go on a few dates and got hitched real quick, like they do. So being LDS is a huge piece of identity for my mom, because she was really trying to establish herself as being LDS, if that makes any sense. My dad is, you know, also from really good Mormon stock on his dad's side, and his father came over to, or not, sorry, his father, his grandfather came to the U.S. from Denmark as a convert to the church. And so it was just a huge part of our identity, was wrapped up in in joining the church, in being a good member. For the most part, though, I did grow up just outside of the Seattle area, and that's a bit more of a liberal-ish area. And so I grew up in a, you know, a conservative Mormon household, but surrounded by people who thought differently than I did and sometimes challenged my beliefs on some things. And so I actually felt like for growing up LDS, like I had a pretty good, well-rounded idea of, at least I shouldn't say the world, but at least of what the American living experience looked like, that, you know, I had seen kind of the duality of that. I feel like the church really became a huge part of my life all through my teenage years. I was very concerned about being as good of a member of the church as possible. I was very, very devout, very Molly Mormon. the young women's leader, it's silly for me to say, but I felt like I was the kid that nobody really worried about. And so the church became something I had to wrestle with a little bit more as I went away to university. I had a boyfriend who was not Mormon, and there were some, I talked about this. I'm a writer for the Exponent, and I talked about this experience when in one of my Exponent posts, and an experience with a bishop in my singles ward who asked me some in-depth questions about the law of chastity. And I was really taken aback. I'd never had a bishop kind of go off book a little bit, and it made me really, really uncomfortable. But also I believe strongly that bishops were called of God, and that if he was asking these questions, that maybe he perceived something in me that not even I knew. And so I started having a lot of anxiety about my worthiness and my standing before God, and all this intersecting while I also now am starting to date this boy who was not a member, but had been investing in the church for a long time. And so I did, I stepped away from the church for about a year in my around 1920, and just had a really hard breakup with that young man. And so I came back to the church because I looked at it as all these things had happened because I had, you know, I didn't have strong enough of a testimony, or I wasn't working hard enough. And so I came back and I was determined to do the most rightest thing, and to be as good of a member as possible. And so I transferred universities I was up at Western Washington University, and I transferred down to BYU so I could be around other people who were living the gospel and maybe find myself a good Mormon husband. So, so I went to BYU and, you know, had a good experience. I actually had a really great experience at BYU for the most part. I really loved the people that I associated with. Again, I was kind of hanging out again in that, that duality of being in a more conservative school, but I was in the music and the theater department. I was doing a minor in theater, and the theater department is known as kind of being this liberal haven on campus. And so again, kind of just always existing in this place of questioning while also maintaining my LDS faith, but acknowledging that maybe there are some cultural issues that we just hadn't worked through as a people yet. And politically a little bit more left-leaning than the majority of my colleagues at BYU. So you
definitely recognize that then, that like your experiences in this little these liberal havens were almost anomaly. Like you were able to recognize that in the larger spectrum of the church, I guess, in the U.S.
Yeah, I did recognize it even then. And I, mostly because I would get into political conversations with other people at BYU, there was a definite difference between when I had these conversations with my classmates in the theater department versus if I worked at BYU Independent Study, and if I was working, you know, talking with my coworkers about it. I definitely noticed that there was a difference. And of course I believed I was right. I actually think that was a really good experience because it allowed me this opportunity to see things from lots of different point of views, even while sharing something in common, which was our faith in the church. And so I hope that that helped make me a slightly more rounded person. I guess I shouldn't say that it did, but I hope it did. But yeah, and my minor in theater was one of the most formative experiences for me, because this is where I was introduced to feminism and Marxism and deconstructionism and postmodernism. These were things that really made me have to kind of peel away my understanding of how the world worked. What's funny though is that it wasn't for years later. I felt like I became a feminist at BYU, that I recognized that the world operated under a certain assumptions and structures that put males in an advantageous place. And I recognized that while I was there and very secularly, but I never really questioned my LDS faith, which is kind of funny to me now, but I never really had any questions about women in the priesthood. I mean, like, of course, like occasionally a question or whatever, but it wasn't something that bothered me. That came a few years later when I was like, oh my goodness, I recognized that there was all of this like political and economic, all these political, economic, and, you know, social structures that privileged men, but I never seemed to acknowledge that was a part of my religious experience as well. So it was actually quite jarring that I could walk through life understanding that it was a problem in one place, but not apply it to the thing that was closest to me.
Well, I was just going to say, I relate to that because I was a sociology major, and it was so, I was just cranked up the cognitive dissonance because I could see these things that we were learning about in school in my undergrad. And then I thought, well, but that's the world's way. But it kind of, I mean, it bugged me, but I wasn't able to fully say, you know, well, the Lord's way should be the same, or, you know, there's that.
Yeah.
You kind of like, you just switch off that. I hate to say this, but it's almost like you just switch off that logic. You switch off that worldview just to fit in to Mormonism.
Well, yeah. And I do think that there's just something about the things that are most precious to us are harder to examine.
Yeah.
I mean, kind of like how we, you know, are so much more willing to forgive our family members or whatever things that they do, because they're, you know, they're close to our hearts. And so I do. I think that it's just something that we treasure. And so it is. And that's something I try to remember when I'm talking to other members who maybe don't quite understand my path or whatever. And I try to remember that it's something that's so precious to them that it actually is really hard for them to even see that there's what I perceive to be a problem there.
Yeah.
So that was BYU. I don't really... No, quite. I guess so. I met my husband at BYU. I was preparing to go on a mission, and I mentioned that I had that boyfriend back in Washington, and our relationship had stepped outside of the bounds of the law of chastity. And so before I went to BYU, like, I was very repentant and, you know, very remorseful about this thing that I had done, and quite a lot of, like, actually just quite a lot of anxiety about feeling like I was not good enough, that I would never be good enough for anyone, you know, those sorts of thoughts. And so I met my husband while we were both on the same stake at BYU. We actually lived in the same housing complex, but different wards. Which is so funny at BYU, right? but we met because his roommate was my stake president, or sorry, a member of my stake presidency's son. And I had come to know that stake presidency member very well, because when I was doing my mission interviews, he asked me to bear my testimony at the atonement. And I started tearing up and kind of crying a bit. And I was like, I just, you know, I really feel like I feel so strongly about the cleansing power of the atonement. And he said, you know, it sounds like you've had a really personal experience with that. Would you like to share that with me? And so then I did. And I probably shouldn't have. And I just said, you know, like, there's this experience, you know, this the sinful life that I used to live. And now the Lord has changed my heart so much. And now, you know, I've repented and I, you know, and now here I am ready to serve the Lord. And he said, well, actually, I'm really sorry to say this, but we have to hold on here for a minute because this is going to have to go to the stake president now. And there's sometimes when you can't serve a mission, if this has been a problem. And I was like, uh-oh. So I was devastated, to be honest, because I felt like this is something that I had already, we talk about the atonement being like Christ taking the atonement, but I felt like I had really atoned. Also, as well as acknowledging my faith in Christ had taken, you know, this sin for me. But I felt like I had gone through the ringer for this personally and, you know, with priesthood leaders, because let's talk about how confessing sins of a sexual nature to a bishop is really, really terrifying as a woman, and especially a young woman. And so I was scared and really disappointed, and I didn't really know what was happening. So I did. I met with stake president, and I had to write a letter to the first presidency in order to be able to serve the mission. So all of this is to say, this is a very tumultuous time in my life, and a lot of uncertainty, because it actually takes a long time to hear back from the first presidency. And I had to go through like a series of interviews with my stake president to ascertain my worthiness and to show that I had repented and to counsel with him and all these things. And again, this is also that happened like a few years before. So it was hard to kind of bring all this up. And it was especially tumultuous because I had not signed any contracts for housing for, like, I had already started deferring my admissions. I just really didn't even know what I was going to be doing. So everything was really up in the air when I meet my husband, Brennan. And, you know, we just started out just good. We just started out as friends. I did re-enroll in BYU and I found a place to live, which was good for me. And we had two of the same classes together. He was taking a theater history class for his civilization credits, and I was taking stats, and we both really needed each other for those. And so I needed help with the stats, if that's not clear. And so we took these classes together and just became good friends. And, you know, like all good friendships at BYU, someday you have to have the determine the relationship talk. And I hadn't really told very many people about this whole thing going on with the stake president and my mission papers. In fact, like a number of people were quite confused because I had been planning on going on a mission and, you know, telling people that I had my mission papers in and everybody in my ward knew, and then there was no call. So, or at least there was nothing coming, and I couldn't say when it would be coming. And that was really confusing to people. And of course I didn't really want to give them a big history of my past, especially being at BYU. And so, Brennan was one of the first people that I kind of opened up to about this. And I, you know, I told him that this is why I didn't really know what was happening with the mission. And we just became really good friends after that. You know, we had already like started hanging out a bit, but there was quite a bit of emotional intimacy around feeling safe enough to tell this person the thing. So here's where we get to where my faith in Mormonism still kind of has some things that I'm working out. Something he told me while we were dating, it was I guess we weren't even technically, maybe we were dating by this point. So now I've opened up to him about this, you know, this reason why I'm not on a mission yet. And he tells me that he experiences same-sex attraction, which, you know, to be honest, like I knew the word gay, I knew gay people at Western Washington University, but there was something about BYU where you didn't use the word gay. And so when he told me he was same-sex attracted, my first thought was that is going to be really hard at BYU to feel this way. And so I just gave him a huge hug, and we're sitting at the duck pond. If any of you know Provo, there's a little duck pond down the hill from the Mazur building. And we were just sitting at the duck pond, and I just gave him this huge hug, and I just said, "Isn't, you know, I'm here for you." And in a lot of ways, it would have seemed like that would have, I mean, in my mind in that moment, I was like, well, I guess this relationship's probably over. And it wasn't for some reason. I think at that point, we kept dating, but kind of more, it was a lot more relaxed. When I was at BYU, I had been I had started dating a few guys, and after a few dates, it started just getting really, like, people started talking about marriage really quickly at BYU. I even had one guy who, I think we had gone on like one date, and he had just moved into the ward, and at one point he was driving me home from like date number two. So as he was driving me back from the second date, he told me, I really felt strongly that I was supposed to move into this ward, and I think it was to meet you. And I first of all, like, I did not really have any feelings for this guy at all at this point. And I was really quite terrified by this. And there was a couple of instances, like, not quite that drastic, but, you know, where it felt like marriage was brought up really frequently. So when Brennan told me this, I thought, well, okay, well, I guess we're kind of just dating for fun at this point. I was getting ready to go on a mission, and, this relationship's probably not going anywhere. So as we're just kind of dating for fun at this point, we kind of kept hanging out, and we had similar interests. He really liked theater, and I liked theater, and we also were both very, it sounds terrible, but I feel like we both loved the church so much, and yet felt like there was something wrong with us that made it so that we had to prove our worthiness more than most people. And so, we've talked about it before. We're like, we were two broken people, or at least we felt that we were broken people, just trying to do the right thing. And so our friendship really developed, and, you know, with time, and actually there wasn't very much time because this is BYU, but you know, emotional intimacy starts to look a lot like love, and we felt very connected to one another, and we decided to get married. And I actually went back to that stake president, because now here I was maybe not going on a mission. And well, actually I still thought maybe I was going on a mission, but I went to go talk to him, and he had seen Brennan and I holding hands at something, and he wanted to talk to me about that to see if I was still planning on going on a mission. And I thought at this point my letter to the first presidency had been sent, that I was waiting for mission, you know, at some either mission papers or some rejection back or something. And so I was really surprised when he told me, "I actually never submitted that because I saw you holding hands with that young man, and I wanted to see what was up with it." And I said, first of all, I was a little bit ticked because I had hoped that my mission papers were in at this point. And, you know, at that point I said, you know, it's funny that you should ask that, because we do, we're still dating, but there's this thing that he's disclosed to me, and I feel like it would make a marriage probably not work. So I told him that Brennan experienced quote unquote same-sex attraction. And his response was that there are all these young men who said that they wanted to do the right thing, that they wanted to get married, and they had every reason to find a woman and start a family and all these things and to get married, because that is the goal at BYU. Like, let's not pretend that it's not. And so, you know, he said, there's all these young men who could do it and who don't do the things that they need to do to get married. And here's a young man who has every reason to say that it's not for him, and yet he's still doing what the Lord would ask him to do. You should definitely hold on to that. And so I took my leader's advice, and I thought, well, he's right. Like, my boyfriend / near to being a fiance is, you know, he's a good man, and he honors his priesthood. He's doing the right things. And what more could I want in a partner than someone who was committed to the Lord and committed to the church, and, you know, just was always going to do the right thing. So we got married, about 4 months after we started dating, and for the non-Mormon listeners here, that's actually not incredibly quickly. at BYU. So we got married, and you know, almost immediately, like, we kind of, it's actually really hard for me to even try to, like, get into my brain. It was hard at first. Like, our first year of marriage was heinous, and for a lot of reasons.
I was just going to ask, was there any sense of him, from him or from you or from your stake president, that he would maybe quote unquote cured from it? I know that's
yeah.
has been a common understanding, that if you just get married to a woman, then suddenly those feelings will go away. Did you run into that at all?
Do you know, not really from my stake president. He was just like, you know, there was this understanding that this maybe doesn't change, but that neither do the Lord's standards, right? Okay. And so you still do the right thing. Now, I know that my husband's bishop, when he tried to talk to him about this very thing, his response was, we come to this life for two reasons. And the first reason is to get a body. And the second reason is to make bodies. And so, like, your purpose here on earth is to have children, essentially, right? And so... And, you know, and of course we were dating at this time, and he was just like, that girl seems really nice. Like, you should just keep going with that.
Oh, that's so hard to hear though. I'm sure as a gay man, like,
I know.
I can't imagine.
Well, and there's something too that I think is really important. I've explained this to other people. I actually think that when we talk about same sex attraction, it changes the conversation instead of being gay. Like, being gay yeah. is a personal identity. It's something that you take on. It's something that you acknowledge as a real thing, versus same-sex attraction, which is, you know, like, it may, you know, I kind of like how guys look, but it's not that big of a deal kind of thing, right? And so, you know, it doesn't acknowledge it as a real personal part of, like, your inner person. And... so, yeah. So, like, I tried to get back into our brains about that time, which is, of course, impossible. But, you know, that we were just two people trying really hard to do the right things and actually didn't even really have language to articulate why this wouldn't work. or, I mean, I shouldn't say wouldn't work, but why this would be difficult. And so... not surprising at all, our first year of marriage was really hard. And some of that is just that the first year of marriage is hard for everybody, I think. Yeah. Maybe it's not, but, you know, you're trying to figure out finances and how to work that out. And also, you know, like, how do you work out? Just lots of things. And so this was just one extra dimension that was kind of thrown into the mix. And I felt took our first year of marriage from a typical first year to just really bad. And then after about the year mark, we had found a good rhythm, and we just realized we were just really good friends, and that was okay. And, you know, I felt like for a few years there, we would occasionally talk about some sexuality, but it wasn't a huge deal. And some of that was that we were both in graduate school. We got pregnant with our first baby while we were in graduate school. And so there's just a lot of other things to kind of be taking up our time and energy. And it was after we moved to Canada, and I was pregnant with our second child, and my husband came to me, and I hate how I responded, but he mentioned that he was having some questions about the church, and I just kind of closed. I was like, you can't, because you see, like, we have this marriage that's predicated on our faith, and so you just don't even get to question it. Or you can kind of question it, but you don't really get to question it, right? And so I was very quickly thrust into this world where I had to face the fact that, again, because my husband had sacrificed so much for the church. And so I'm like, this isn't an issue of, like, not wanting to do what the church is asking, you know, is asking us to do, or not wanting to live a righteous life or whatever. Like, there might be something to it. And so I started reading some things with, you know, like, I think he brought home a copy of Mormon Enigma one day, and we started reading through some of the things, and we were just... It's funny now, the things that were so bothersome, then I'm like, eh, whatever now. Yeah. you know, like the word, you know, like, the account of how the word of wisdom was received and things like that, they were like, oh my goodness, you know, what else don't we know? And that kind of sent us down the rabbit hole. I felt like my husband had been sitting on these questions for a lot longer than I had. And kind of, I guess, like, I probably was the first one to have a quote unquote faith crisis while after the temple, actually, after I received my endowment. I found that to be a very jarring experience and really not just aspiritual, but for me, it was very anti-spiritual. I felt like I went into the temple feeling very connected to God and very at one with the Savior and whatnot. And then I came out of the temple and it had been such a jarring experience that I actually was like, I don't even know that God exists, because I had always been told my entire life that this is where I would feel God the most. And it was the place where I actually felt the most absence in my entire life. And that's, I know that some people have a really great temple experience, so I don't want to suggest that that's what the temple is, but for me, it was just a very jarringly awful experience. And so I that actually was a difficult part of our first year of marriage too, is that I was like, I don't even know that there is a God. And so there's all these things that we had moved forward in doing, like getting married or where we were going to school and all these things. And I did not know where I stood on that. I did have some better experiences and that kind of simmered a bit, but at the time, Brennan had been my rock. Like, he was the one who, you know, would talk to me about things of the church and would kind of help put my mind at ease about some things. And so when he came to me, which I know he'd been sitting on these questions for years, and, you know, finally comes out to me. And so he had had kind of this long time to not necessarily investigate, but like he just, you know, asked himself some questions about some things and came to some different conclusions and whatnot. Whereas I felt like it was a bit of an explosion of information. And it was a really, my time of starting to question the church was, it felt just like I was constantly in fast forward. And part of that was that I was pregnant when my husband told me, and then I had my second baby, and I had started having all of these questions about, you know, about the role of women in the church. And I started reading all of this, these essays by, I think, Valerie Hudson, about like the two trees and all this stuff. So like kind of alternative feminist ways of looking at women not holding the priesthood. And so I had really started to kind of buy into this idea that like my role as a woman was to be the guardian of the first veil, or, you know, like my priestesshood was welcoming children into this world and things like that. And I had a really traumatic birth with my second child, and I had done all the right things. I had a midwife, I, you know, like with, like having this like hippy dippy birth, and it went very wrong, and it was very traumatizing. And I came out of that experience again being like, this is a time when I was told that God, and not just God, but like Heavenly Mother, that this is the place where I was going to meet this person. And like the temple, it was so, again, just so jarring and so absent that I just was like, I don't even know that there is a God. Once again, like, this seems to be like a cycle for my life where I get my hopes up that this is going to be the place where I find God, and then I don't, and it's awful.
I relate to it so much, both in my temple experience and with my first birth. So I'm right there with you.
Yeah. Well, these are things too that I feel like in Mormonism, that we put these things on pedestals as the spiritual experiences, the place where you experience God the most. And then if you don't, like, what's wrong with you, right?
Yeah. Well, I remember the first time I went through the endowment, I legitimately sat there thinking like, all right, they're going to introduce Heavenly Mother any second now, any second now, any second now. And then suddenly it was over and I'm like, wait, what, wait, rewind. It was devastating, but you can't be devastated too long because you're getting married the next week. You know, you can't like throw a temper tantrum because how do you do that, you know?
Well, exactly. And there's no time related process at all, right? Mm-hmm. I think I went to the temple 10 days before we got married. And, you know, at this point, I'm still trying to get things ready for a wedding. And I have people, we got married near my husband's family because that's where all my extended family was. So like trying to figure out accommodations for, you know, like those sorts of things. There's so many logistical things that you don't even really have time to like sit with your discomfort. And so it just gets shoved to the side and then it all bubbles up later.
Yeah. Well, same thing when you have a baby too. Now suddenly you can't process the trauma that you just had because now you have a new human that you have to take care of.
And you have to take care of. And yeah, that was really, that was hard. And so that is really kind of what launches me into Mormon feminism, because I thought, well, these people who said that this was where I was going to have this great feminist, you know, not feminist, I should say, feminine enhancing experience or whatever, that I would come to some peace about my questions about women in the priesthood was through this experience. And I was like, well, that did not work. So that's baloney. And now I'm going to go over here with these people because they're asking the questions that I still have. And they're not giving me any ridiculous answers about like, if you have this experience, you will know. They're saying, no, like there's some structural problems here that we need to address. And so I started following Ordained Women, launched in April. So I had my baby in February of 2013, and Ordained Women launched April of 2013. So I was ripe for some, I was so excited about Ordained Women when it officially launched. I was not ready to be out about my feminist leanings with friends and family, but I followed that pretty closely for a couple of months. And then in August, I submitted my profile very quietly. I did not, I didn't tell people that I had done it, but I submitted it in August. And then I was outed by my own Facebook lack of knowledge when they posted about the first Ordained Women Action, which for those who aren't familiar, the people from Ordained Women went to Temple Square and during the semi-annual general conference, during the priesthood session, which is an all-male session, women asked to be admitted. And the reasoning was that priesthood session was for members of the priesthood and potential members of the priesthood. So people, the understanding is like people who are investigating. And so the reasoning was, we are potential members of the priesthood and we would like to attend. And it was, you know, like there was a lot of excitement around this because Ordained Women kind of, again, like came through very quickly. Like there were all these, I mean, just a few months before women finally like openly wore pants to church wear pants to church day. And then all of a sudden Ordained Women like bursts on the scene and just really takes off. So it took a lot of people by surprise, I think. But for me, it was very exciting. And on the Facebook event for the action, I had been typing, you know, and when people like trolls come on and are saying mean things and I'd respond to them, but I had no idea that that was public. And so here now, all of my friends and family can see that I am advocating for the ordination of women. And I had not told any of them at this point that I felt that way. So that caused some problems pretty quickly. Also, you should never be friends with your bishop on Facebook. so that was how I was outed as a supporter of Ordained Women. And at that point, I was like, well, I guess I've already done this. So I guess people might as well, you know, I wasn't very secret even about the questions I was having about truth claims, about my own faith crisis and things like this. But I really felt strongly, again, like I was really excited by the Ordained Women movement. And in a lot of ways, I think that Ordained Women is what was my lifeline for the church for a long time. I wanted to believe that the church could make something right again, and that I could be part of advocating for it to be made right. And so for the year between when I submitted my profile and when Kate Kelly was excommunicated, it just really was the thing that kept me going. It kept me going to church. I really wanted to set an example as someone who was a feminist, but still very involved at church and still active and participating. And when Kate Kelly was excommunicated, it was devastating. For a while, I thought maybe I could still try to make it work. And I did, but not great. So it was in March of 2015. So Kate Kelly was excommunicated, I believe, in July of 2014. And then in March of 2015, we just kind of had a lot of personal stuff going on with our family. And my husband and I sat down and said, what needs to change? How are we going to... Oh, we were having marital issues, so if that's important for people. But, in our marriage, we're there's a lot going on right now, and we need to change course and direction, and what are the things that are going to stay, what's going to go, what are we going to bring in? And we both agreed that the church was putting a huge stress on ourselves and on the marriage, because we would go to church, and it was not spiritually nourishing at all. It was really draining, and we would both come home, just really frustrated and really hurt and very angry. And repeating that cycle week after week is exhausting. And so that was one of the things that we felt like needed to change. We actually need to stop going to church. And we maybe need to find, maybe we need to find a new church home, or at least go investigate other things that are out there. And for about 6 months, we had second Saturdays and went and did things with our family on Sundays. And it was actually quite nice. And then one day, the sister missionaries, we are now on the radar. So 6 months have gone and we haven't really shown up to church at all. And so the sister missionaries start coming over, and on their third time, which was, over about a month, they came over, and finally the conversation turns to, why aren't we at church? And they're very kind in the way that they asked. But they were just like, well, we see you there tomorrow. And I turned to my husband and I said, I believe we're going to Community of Christ tomorrow. And we had actually not gone before. but I, it was the thing that came to my lips. And we had talked about going to attend a service. And my husband had attended one time by himself about a year earlier. So, there are reasons why we would maybe go, but it was pretty out of the blue. And so we did. The next morning we woke up and we're like, well, we're not going to lie to the sister missionaries. We should go. So we did. So we went to our first Community of Christ service. And I was actually quite unprepared for what it would look like. A lot of my understanding about Community of Christ comes from former members of the LDS Church who attend Community of Christ. And so I kind of thought that this was this little liberal ex-Mormon haven. And I got there and there weren't any other former members. And so I was actually a little bit disappointed, because I was still really processing this, our exit from the church. I hadn't anticipated that would be what happened eventually. And I was still kind of sad about it. And, and I wanted this place where I was going to get to talk to other people who had left. And that wasn't what we found. We found a congregation that was quite a bit, like many Community of Christ congregations, is mostly older people. And, but it was a really lovely experience. Of course, we walk in and one of our children's name is Hiram, and they're like, so that gave us away really quickly. And but they were just very wonderful. One of the things I love about our congregation, we still do this right now, we're in a temporary space. But when we first came, we were still in our old building. And they just had an area set up in the back with toys and coloring and puzzles and whatever, so that during the service, the kids could hang out in the back and do their thing. And we could attend, we could sit and listen to a service. And that was really the first time since we became parents that I wasn't worrying about a child wandering around in the pews or whatever. Right. And so this is one of those things where I remind myself that structural changes make a huge difference, right? The fact that I could sit and listen to a service and have the opportunity to be touched by what is being said because I'm not wrangling a child to sit in a pew makes a big difference in how I process a Sunday service. So, so that was my first Sunday experience with Community of Christ. We kept coming for a few weeks and then, you know, and then stopped for a little while because we were visiting family and whatever. And then we kind of just attended intermittently, but we always felt like we were really wanted. And I mean, I don't think it would be wrong to say that they really loved that we have children and there aren't a lot of children in our congregation. And so I think they didn't want to lose us on one hand, but people were just very kind and, you know, would check in on us every once in a while. And they're like, if you want to come, here's this activity, or, you know, we'd love to have you do this if you want to, but like everybody was very, chill about our being there and our not being there. And then we started attending more in about October of last year, more regularly. And I became very good friends with, we have a revitalization minister, and I'm just going to give a shout out to Parker. So he was brought up to Calgary from the US as well that summer. And, when the election happened in the States, we decided to have a little mini election party because we thought it was going to be a night of great victory. And so I invited Parker over because I'm like, you're an American, like, let's, you know, have our little American thing. And Parker and I became really fast friends. I mean, we had talked a little bit before then, but that was really the first time when, again, you go through a little bit of emotional turmoil together because we were upset about those election results. And you go through a little bit of personal turmoil together and you bond over it. And so we've remained really good friends ever since then. And it was really, I think back to Gordon B. Hinckley saying that everybody in the church needs a friend. And I did, I needed a friend. And so that was kind of when we really started working with Community of Christ a lot more. It's kind of sometimes kind of crazy to think that it's, it hasn't been a ton of time. It's been almost a year, I guess, or it's been about a year and a half since we started attending, almost a year since we started attending more regularly. And, I really felt like towards the end of last year, we had John Hamer come out to Calgary to talk about congregation renewal and things like that. And John and I got to talk a bit, and I really caught this vision of what Community of Christ is and what it can be. And I felt a lot more personal calling to be part of that. And so I was confirmed a member just about 3 weeks ago. So that brings me to Community of Christ, and here I am, and I'm, it does. It feels like a family, and I'm just really excited to see where this path takes us for me personally and for our family.
I relate to a lot of elements of your story, and I really like that you talked about meeting John Hamer and catching the vision of who Community of Christ is. Man, you just gave so much good stuff. I'm just like, mic drop.
Well, so I wanted to just touch on this really fast because I felt like I like dangled out this, like, I'm in this mixed orientation marriage, and then dropped it. But that's been actually, I think, the hardest thing that's from leaving the LDS church is, and I know that we're not the first people to do this, but you kind of have to reevaluate all of your reasons for doing things, right? Like, before, our reason for being in our marriage and staying in our marriage was doing the right thing. It doesn't matter if you have some suffering in this life. Like, you'll get, like, rockin' eternities, right? So, actually, it's really, if I can find it, I'm going to find this funny little poem that, maybe I won't find it, but there's a book out that all of your readers who like art and Mormon history, it's a book of poetry called Glossolalia. And, it's poems written, like, each title of a poem is for one of the wives of Joseph Smith. And one of them talks about how, here's my boring, boring life. And, you know, just uses the word boring over and over again. I think it's Sarah Ellis. And then at the end, it's like, but my eternities will be extraordinary or something like that. And I really identified with that, that like our lives would be, you know, hard and, you know, it'd be difficult for us to work in this mixed orientation marriage, but dang it, we were going to have rocking eternities and it was going to be great. And so, you know, when that is kind of taken out of the equation, it's a lot harder to try to navigate what is our life going to look like now. And some of that's just circumstantial. Like, we have children and, you know, we've decided that at least for now, we're good enough friends that we keep that going. And, but it's one of those things where I feel really strongly about when people talk about basing their relationships on faith. And this is not just Mormon families, or Mormon couples who base their relationships on their faith. But it's a really dangerous thing to do because, you know, it's sometimes hard and almost unimaginable to think that you might lose your faith, especially when you're in a place of great faith, or great belief, I should say, is probably more accurate because I think it's belief, not faith. When you're in a place of great belief, it's really hard to imagine a world where you might not have that anymore. But that's something that I've learned, even just moving forward in anything, right? That I'm like, you really have to understand that there are lots of things that we base our life decisions on, and to be open to flexibility and to also acknowledge that you really can't base your life on things that can shift, or you have to be comfortable knowing that they might actually, probably more accurately, you have to be comfortable knowing that things in life change, and that you always have to be open to the fact that something might change that means that the decisions that you make today won't have the same reasoning as they do tomorrow, and learning how to navigate that space with as much grace as you can possibly muster. Well, sorry, that kind of felt out of the blue, but I felt like I dropped that.
No, it's good. And I'm glad you brought it up because it had me thinking, you know, almost like your salvation was this carrot that was being dangled in front of you. And the theology of community of Christ is so different, that, you know, we believe that we can be saved. We can be reconciled here. And we don't necessarily have, you know, strong claims on what the afterlife is going to look like, et cetera. And where everything is so defined with Mormonism and you make huge decisions based on those claims and based on those beliefs and even promises that this will be fixed, or like you said, you'll have a rockin' eternity. And then to suddenly have that dissolve, I mean, that brings a level of devastation to a faith transition that I think is not, I don't even know how to describe it. Like, it's not normal. Like, there's an amount of trauma there, I would assume, that goes beyond just a heterosexual couple going through it together.
I mean, I think so, but I only know my experience, I guess. And I know that we're not the only, you know, I've read the stories of other couples who, as they've been exiting Mormonism, who they maybe realize that they're in heteronormative couples that, you know, maybe this match wasn't, maybe it was based too much on faith, and maybe they get divorced. And I also think it's important to recognize I feel sometimes like we push back on this when people say, well, you've changed and or that people change, and we try to say like, no, like we just like got to the core of who we were. But I actually do think people change. Our experiences change who we are. I am not the same person that I was, you know, 4 or 5 years ago even. And so, and neither is my husband. My husband is a different person. And I think everybody who goes through a faith transition, I mean, that's a very large neurological change. That the way that you see the world is very different afterwards. And so people change, and our relationships there also they have to be more flexible if we want to keep them, you know, together, like, we have to approach things in a different way. Or maybe that means that they dissolve or whatever, right? But that's something that I feel like we often talk about as this great tragedy of faith transitions. And there have definitely been times when I have felt very woe is me about all of this. And I've really had to learn to go back to the person that I was when I made these big decisions and honor their reason, their reasoning. The Amy who chose to enter into a mixed orientation marriage was very, very devout and, you know, really wanted to do what was right in the sight of God. She maybe had some very naive beliefs, but she came by them honestly. And I feel like we all need to be more compassionate with our former selves and to just sit with that person that we once were and acknowledge the good intentions that they had. And that's something I still really struggle to do that. I don't want to pretend like I'm, you know, this great guru, but it is something I've been trying to do a lot more recently is to honor that, to honor that place that they were in. And I hope that the me of tomorrow will honor the me of today that probably will also make some big decisions that I'll look back on and be like, I don't really know why you did that. but yeah.
Well, I think that that is one way to kind of move beyond the anger stage. I mean, I think that leaving something like the LDS Church is a very intense thing, obviously, and you have to go through different stages of grief. So there should be an anger period. I mean, that's healthy.
Oh, agreed.
But totally a lot agreed. Of people will get hung up in that, and then they aren't able to replace it with healthy community, spirituality, etc. But I think honoring our past and honoring those moments and those decisions that we made out of the best intentions. I mean, I was going to say you were honest to a fault. I mean, hearing you talk about your mission, I mean, that just kind of broke me a little bit. Like just picturing this woman who had, you know, gone through the atonement, the Mormon atonement, and who had done all the right things and who had a testimony of that. And through sharing her testimony was then, you know, essentially denied or incredibly delayed the opportunity to serve. I mean, from a Mormon perspective, that's really, really rough. But to be able to acknowledge that, you know, even if we're honest to a fault and even if it turns our lives upside down, you know, that's part of our story and owning it and claiming it. And I think that that's one thing that Community of Christ has helped me do with church history is, I mean, there's some wacky stuff that went on and that wacky stuff was part of what left me out of the LDS church. And so sometimes people say, you know, how can you still be in a church that was started by Joseph Smith? And, but I think that it's what you're speaking to is this honoring of the story, your personal story, our collective story, and just trying our best to see that people were doing the best they could, or maybe they weren't. Maybe they really were just, you know, I mean, people make mistakes, people mess up.
Though it's really important that we recognize that these things happen or, like there's very scientific way to approach history. And, but at the end of the day, like we all create meaning around that. So, and this is why two people can read the same church history account from, you know, from either the Community of Christ / RLDS tradition or LDS, and they can read these things and one person can be very, very disturbed by it. And one person is going to be totally fine with it. And I think it's the meaning that we create behind it. And I'm a big advocate for, again, everybody does need to go through the anger stage. And and I still actually go through angry moments. But I do think that there comes a point where we can step back and say, like, we can still have, this can still be meaningful in my life. Right after my confirmation, I had not told my parents when I was being confirmed. I told them about how I was going to do this. They were sad by that. I actually feel like they were sadder that I joined a church than that I wasn't attending another one. But that kind of makes sense to me a little bit, right? Like it puts a bit of finality on my LDS experience to join another church. But I hadn't told them about what it was and or about when it was happening, but I wrote about it after I was confirmed. Sorry about my parents. So I told them I was joining the Community of Christ And I asked them if they wanted to know when I was being confirmed or if they would rather not know. And if they would maybe like to attend if they could. And their response was that they would prefer not to do that. And they weren't terribly interested in when it was happening. So I sat down to write about that experience because I did want to share with my friends and family in a way that let them know that this had happened. Cause I don't really like walking around in the shadows anymore. For those few months when I had submitted my ordained woman profile and didn't tell anybody, they were really unnerving because I'm just always worried that I was going to say something and out myself. So anyway, but as I was writing about my experience with my confirmation, and I framed it kind of as a letter to my 8-year-old self, about her choice to be baptized. And again, tried to step into this place of really honoring that choice. I was brought back to this quote I heard years ago about how it's never too late to have a happy childhood. And because we create meaning around our experiences. And I think that we can, if we want to, not everybody wants to or is able to, like there's some experiences that I'm not going to suggest that this is right or even healthy. But I think a lot of times we can take some more negative experiences and have the opportunity to kind of flesh them out a little bit and to allow ourselves space to have mixed feelings about them, that we can acknowledge both the happiness and the anger, or both the delight that we had in this and how hard that was for us. And so, and that's kind of just how that is what I've loved about Community of Christ, is that we can say like, these things happened and it was hard. But look at where we are now and look at how that changed who we are as a people, and even our having to wrestle with this, how that's made us more open and more honest and, more able to have disagreements about things than maybe some other faith traditions would. So, and a lot of us, I'm really grateful for our messy three. I think that it has made us better people.
I think so too. And I think that that's how we continue to ask questions and we continue to push ourselves. It's all part of the prophetic journey that I think is really beautiful. And so sometimes, I have to admit, sometimes I get sad when I see some of my friends who have left the LDS church, and I understand that being in church and et cetera isn't for everybody, but I think that a lot of people are very quick to just turn their back on everything. And so I'm grateful that I've been able to salvage it. And, it makes me a little bit sad to see people that are still in pain. I know some people that have been out for years and years and years and years and years. And I just don't know. I don't know. I just don't know how to reach them and not even to bring them into church, any church. But just to kind of help foster some of that healing, and just to say, it's okay. Mm-hmm. You can claim that part of your life and it doesn't have to continue to control you. So I really like the quote that you just said, that it's never too late to have a happy childhood.
Yeah. And by that same token, I think that we also have to learn to trust the person that is in front, like the person who we will become, right? That, that we can exercise some grace with our past. And I'm somebody who gets a lot of anxiety. By now, like I've done all these things where I did all the right things and then like those experiences really let me down. And so like sometimes it's kind of hard to look forward to something I'll be pretty open about like my marriage. We sit in this new place with where our LDS faith is no longer what keeps us going. And I've, and sometimes I get really flustered by like, what am I going to do? What am I going to do with my marriage? Like we've had questions about the church for almost 5 years now, and we still haven't done anything. And to sometimes just learn to sit and rest and say, that decision is not for today. Or maybe it is, but I don't feel like it is for today. And that decision is probably for tomorrow. And I'm going to trust myself of tomorrow to make the right choices. And just all around, I feel like we need to learn to trust. We talk about trusting ourselves, but usually in this context of like like trust yourself right now. And I'm like, I feel like it actually takes a little bit more effort for us to learn to trust ourselves in the past and in the future. And how can I tie this into community Christ? I'm kidding. But I mean, and that's, I think one of the things that I like about the Latter-day Seeker program is I feel like it's this looking to the future. So, I mean, at least this is my take on it, because I look at my little congregation and I live in I'm not sure if everyone is aware, but, Alberta is quite Mormon. There's quite a large Mormon populace here. It's not Salt Lake or Provo by any stretch of the imagination, but when polygamy was, you know, starting to go underground, what happened was, as many of your listeners are probably aware, is that a lot of the polygamous families moved up to Canada or down to Mexico. And so Southern Alberta has quite a large LDS population. And of course, that's a lot of smaller farm towns at this point, and Cardston. Not huge towns, but a lot of those people, like the kids, move up to the cities, right? So the Mormon corridor extends all the way up to about Edmonton, Alberta. So like here in which is north of where we are, for those not geographically inclined. So I look at my little congregation here, and again, I was really surprised by the fact that there weren't other LDS people here, just because we do have such a large LDS population. And where you have a large LDS population, you have a large disaffected LDS population. And so one of the things I really liked about the Latter-day Seeker program is that I feel like it's this way to look to the future in the church, that in the community of Christ, and for the LDS church, I hope, for those who, for whatever reason, that's not working out for them. And this way to like forge this new identity of, you know, like what can be our story after Mormonism doesn't work? We can still be like, I still feel very Mormon through and through, but what can be my way of still manifesting the parts of the restoration that I just love and adore? You know, the idea of us being a prophetic people, of building Zion. Now we, of course, conceptualize Zion as where we are, but Zion building and always being open that God can lead us in a different way. And I hope that it can be a place of comfort for some people. And one of the things that I love the most about my experience in Community of Christ is that I have always kind of felt like I like to think of myself as this change maker. And when I was in the LDS church and trying to operate within that framework and structure, I feel like I was just constantly running up against brick walls, right? Like there's really not very much. If you want to change something, there's just really not much you can do. Mm-hmm. Like maybe you can change how the compassionate service director operates or something, but there's just not very much. There's not very much room for creativity or for exploration. And that is not something I felt like. I felt the complete opposite in my congregation here in Calgary, that I, in Community of Christ, I can say, you know, I really think that maybe we should do something this way, or, you know, like there's an opportunity to see a place where things could be different, or where things maybe need to change, or maybe how we talk about something needs to change. And it's possible to do that. And, but that takes a lot. I think that can be unnerving and jarring to some people, that it can move like that. But again, I think that we have to come to this place where we trust where that's going to go, that we are doing the best that we can, and we're going to do right by our principles, by our guiding principles, and that we can, you know, your Sunday experience in Community of Christ can be what you want it to be, and you have the opportunity to contribute to this just ever changing, but like in a very dynamic way. So I find it all very exciting, and that's probably one of the reasons why Community of Christ was so appealing to me.
I relate to that a lot. I, going from feeling like you were, like you said, kind of up against a brick wall, and that you were being, I don't know, left out of decisions, even little decisions, that's like, well, what if I have an opinion about this? Or not being able to create anything. But when I came to Community of Christ, that's what it was all about, is you working with the congregation, with leadership, and you're actually able to help create the path forward, which was a little hard. It still is hard, but it was a little hard for me to accept at first, because I had been such a consumer, I guess, in church. But then mm-hmm. to be part of the production was, like you said, a little bit jarring, but also really exciting. And I feel like the possibilities are endless, because if you want to start up a ministry, you just kind of do it, you know?
Yeah. Well, and I don't know about you, Brittany, but one thing that's really helped me, and I actually feel like this has helped me come to some more kind feelings towards the LDS Church, is that when you are part of the production, as you say, like, you understand that sometimes there are so many moving parts, and you're doing the best that you can, and like, you're going to make mistakes. Because I feel like in the LDS Church, so many people are left out of that experience. Most people are not like really on the inside helping to make change, or to even like customize to their area's needs or whatever. And I actually feel like it's harder to be forgiving with leadership when you're not even allowed a lot of times to be part of that production. And so now, you know, as we're trying to work on things, I'm like, oh yeah, like I drop the ball sometimes too. Or I can understand, like, I totally say the wrong thing sometimes, and I'm so sorry. Do you know, like, I just feel like there's more opportunities to see the humanness in other people. And I feel like it's made me more forgiving of people's mistakes, or that sometimes things don't move as quickly as I want them to move, or whatever, right? Because I see a lot more of what's going on the inside in faith communities that I didn't see when I'm in the LDS Church. And I mean, and it's structurally set up so that you don't. so it's both something that makes me sad about the LDS experience, the Utah LDS experience, is that there's not as many opportunities to be involved in very human experiences of faith communities and structures and things like that. And that's, I actually think that's probably one of the reasons why the LDS Church is having kind of a harder time when people do start to question that, because they're not really involved and not able to really kind of see things on the inside, that it's very alienating to them. And that's one thing I have loved about Community of Christ, is just how open it is about practices and you know, like, it's totally okay if you disagree with something that has happened or that's being done. And that's just a very different experience, and one that's been very healing for me.
Those are all really good observations, and not something that I really thought about before, but I think you're right. So what advice would you have for people who are seeking, whether they're specifically seeking to Community of Christ? I mean, I guess if they've made it through this podcast, they have some amount of interest. But yeah, what would your advice be? Because I know when Nancy Ross and I were talking, we just kind of talked a little bit about things that we've talked about, you and I, just that, you know, the service might be different, or there might be, you know, there might not be a lot of young families, et cetera. But I mean, you kept going. So I guess what would your advice be to people who might be in that same boat, or who are nervous to attend for the first time, or who don't know if they're going to go back if they've been a couple times before? How did you really see that spark with John Hamer to know that you were going to keep going?
That's a good question.
It was kind of a long rambled question. So hopefully.
Well, it is actually one of those questions I've asked myself, like, why did you decide to keep doing this? So here would be my personal piece of advice. I felt like I caught this vision of what could be and what is, not just in ways to change it, but what Community of Christ is and can be. And there was this moment where I thought, I'm not 100% sure. Like, is this something I want to devote my time, my talents, like even financial resources and things like that? I'm like, is this something I really want to do? And like, if I join, there's some commitment there. And am I okay with that? And one of the things that I My whole life, especially as a young LDS woman, your whole life is kind of planned out for you. You are going to go through Young Women's, you're going to finish that program, you're going to walk out of there with a fancy medallion. I guess you don't anymore. I hear you get stickers, but you got your young womanhood medallion. You go to university. You might go on a mission. You have children. You get married first. You get married. You have children. And then you live out your life as preferably a stay-at-home mother. And then you have grandchildren. You maybe serve a mission with your husband, and then you get to go to the Celestial Kingdom in the end. And so, like, I was so used to having this life plan out for me that choosing anything that took me off of that life plan was really terrifying for kind of a while. It frankly kind of still is. But so when I was looking at joining Community of Christ, I was like, I actually don't know where this goes after this. So if I join, then, like, there's not a well-laid plan, except for, like, you know, I go to church on Sundays. And so this actually became an exercise that I had to sit with for a while and say, why does that scare you? You know, like, well, you know, I'm used to having my life planned out for me. And so when I felt like I should join Community of Christ, I was like, can you follow that feeling for a while? And where is that? Does it feel like I feel like it's that whole, like, Alma experience. You know, experiment upon the word thing. Like, do you feel good about that? Well, if you feel good about that, why not go forward? You don't know what's going to happen after this. So you're not actually committing to, like, I mean, I'm not entirely sure what, like, could be the most commitment in Community of Christ, but, you know, like, you're not committing that you're going to, you know, like, have to become, you know, like, have to get to some certain rank or that you have to live out your life, you know, in any particular fashion after this, except for, you know, to try to model your faith and beliefs and your practices and your behaviors. But, there's some discomfort and also comfort in learning to kind of live with the unknown. And in the end, that actually was one of the reasons why I chose to join, was that I wasn't 100% sure what life was going to look like afterwards. And I wanted to take this step, and so I did. And that's something I feel like as Latter-day Saints, that we, those who grew up in the LDS tradition, that's really difficult for us to do, is to be comfortable taking one step at a time instead of needing the entire path before us. Because that's imagery I know that I grew up with, that the way is straight and narrow. The path is before you. You know what it's supposed to be. The prophets have told you what it's supposed to be. And, life just doesn't always work that way. And I think that anybody who's gone through a faith transition realizes that life, we don't actually know. Like, and that comes down even to our faith, right? Like, we don't really have any great conception of the afterlife. Like, it's this unknown that you kind of have to learn to be comfortable with at some point. And I had to be comfortable with, I didn't have to, but I chose to be comfortable choosing to be confirmed into this faith tradition that I've come to love so dearly, without knowing, what would come afterwards. So that would be my advice, is to learn to kind of sit with that discomfort and to follow what feels right inside. And you can call that the spirit. You can call that, you know, your intuition or whatever, but learning to appreciate it and follow it.
You are full of a lot of really good wisdom. This has been really good.
I practice. No, I'm kidding.
No, I feel like I should totally be taking joking. Notes, and then I'm like, oh, wait, we're recording this. I can go back and listen to it again. Oh, that's really Well, thank you for your time and for sharing your story. This is a really good episode. Well,
thanks, Brittany. I really love what you're doing here at Project Zion. So, well, thanks for having me on. I've enjoyed this.
The views expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official views of the Latter-day Seekers team or of Community of Christ. The music has been provided by Ben Howington. You can find his music at mormonguitar.com.
I'm not sure exactly how you want to end this.
Well, yeah. We can cut all that part out.
Yeah, it's cool. But.